It's Legal Defense with Kirk Hobert on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of Legal Defense, joined once again by my good friend and co-host, John Birdsall.
Yes. Good morning. How is your Saturday going so far?
Well, so far, so good. I'm enjoying the company of yourself and all of our many listeners. You know, last week we talked quite a bit about the election, and it's one of those things that we can't stop talking about.
Because it's in our face every single day, every minute of every single day. So, yes.
Right. And I'm actually getting to that point where I think, like most people, I really can't wait for this to be over, just because one thing is the suspense, but also just on a daily basis, it's getting more silly.
It's getting more and more embarrassing. The rest of the world has, I haven't traveled internationally while this case has been, while this election's been going on, but my God, I can only imagine what folks in other countries are saying. It's like they're looking at us going, really? You want us to copy you? Is that what you're telling us? Because that seems to be your constant message, is that, you know, American democracy is the model upon which all these other countries that you're trying to nation build should be premised on. And if this is what it looks like, not so sure about it.
Yeah,
I'm guessing that's what they say. I don't know.
No, I think it is. And you do have to consider the fact that part of our, as you said, nation building around the world, part of the reason why we, you know, have opposed bettering relations with Cuba, the reason why we are involved in many of our conflicts in the Middle East still continuing, has to do with a stated goal of promoting democracy throughout the world as the most fair and humanitarian way of ruling a government. But what I want to do for part of the show today anyway is I want to try and steer the boat down the middle of the channel for a little bit here. And I want to talk about some of the issues that came up in the debate earlier this week. And, I really want to try hard not to advocate for one party or the other, but really to talk about the issues that have come up.
All right.
And from a legal perspective, talk about, the real legal impact of how these things affect us as people, you know. And that's one of the things that I think there's a lot of apathy out there. And when people say they're just not going to vote because they don't like the candidates, or I heard somebody say recently that it's someone's prerogative to not vote, and it's really not democratic to force people to vote or to encourage voting for that matter. I'm not sure I agree with that. But, you know, these are issues that do have a potential and real impact on each and every one of us. And there are many examples of leadership having a direct and palpable influence directly on your life. The perpetuation of the Vietnam War, for one thing, was something that, based upon the president's wishes, and it was really Johnson that decided to escalate things, you know, that affected people because we lost 18-year-old boys that were going off to fight in a war that they knew nothing about. And ultimately, of course, Vietnam remained communist and still is. That's just one example. But I want to talk really about three separate topics that came up. The one that bothers me the most, and both candidates are guilty of this, is not being careful to limit their comments and their so-called policies to what the president can actually do. And we have to remember, this is all stuff we learned in government class in high school, but just as a gentle reminder to those of us that seem to have forgotten, the president has very limited powers, and it's by design that it's equalized by other branches of the government so as to make it so that a president cannot dictate, much like a monarch or a dictator, policy issues across the board. And a lot of these ideas where we're going to create so many millions of jobs or cut so many taxes and other things like that, you know, they're ideas is all they are. And the real problem that no one has done a good job of discussing is, what does a president actually do in order to affect these ideals? And the thing we have to remember is that, and I think it's true when people say this, neither candidate has a very promising potential to be able to work with Congress. And I think...
Wow, yeah. You know what? You're 100% right. You know, really, when I'm listening to your description here, I'm reminded of how the founders really depended on that tension between the branches to prevent extremism, in a sense, whether it be a monarchy or whatever.
If there's one thing they didn't want, they did not want, and it's built into our constitutional structure, that one person doesn't get to decide how the country is run. I mean,
it's a very frustrating thing, because everybody wants their policy and everybody wants to do things a certain way, and they can't because somebody else is obstructing them. And in certain senses, a Scalia would say, for example, you can change anything you want, just amend the Constitution, you know, like you can snap your fingers and wave a wand or do whatever, you know, it's like that easy. But in a sense, he's right. I mean, think about slavery, for example. I mean, that was not only a state versus federal issue at a North versus South issue, but it was also a question of how, let's say, the anti-slavery forces are going to prevail, as they did when they passed the 13th Amendment, for example. But the tensions to get there were enormous. I mean, obviously, we had to fight a war to get there, but that's just one example. You know, I mean, it could be Jim Crow laws in the South. It could be, what do we want to do in terms of entering a conflict, the conflict in Europe before World War II, for example, you know? But those sorts of, you're right. You're 100% right that neither one of these people, if they're elected, are going to be able to command, like, say, a Reagan did or a Clinton did, to essentially run the table on the power, the houses of government. You know, I mean, I predict, even if Clinton wins huge, to use a Trumpian term, and let's say the Democrats take the Senate and substantially increase their numbers in the House, she's still going to have a really tough time governing because of, she's going to be viewed in essence as a third term of Barack Obama, and it was bad enough we had a black man, according to some, but now we're going to have a woman. You know, this is just too much change. We want to go back to that 50s thing.
I know, but let me just point one other thing out. If you look at how divided the country is, and you know, these polls, the most recent ones have shown Hillary to be ahead. Of course, these are popular polls, and one thing that does bother me is that if you add the Electoral College forecasts, at the margin's even wider just because of the way states appear to be divided up. And that's one thing that I think that we have to take a very hard look at whether the Electoral College does have relevance anymore in our current era. And, you know, it goes back to the need to include people that didn't have the ability to travel long distances in order to vote. It goes back to, a basic idea that electors are people that are supposed to be accountable and responsible to the electorate. But, you know, the way that it actually works is that after Election Day, the electors don't cast their votes until December.
That's
kind of
true.
Kind of weird the way that works.
I was just going to say that I think that part of the reason that it was a good idea, in a sense, to have an electoral college type matrix, if you will, was to give certain parts of the country, less populated parts, some sort of grab on powers. The same reason that we have a Senate where each state gets two elected members of the Senate, regardless of size. And And instead of having, like, I mean, just think if we had just a straight popular vote, that there would be screams of about how unfair that is, because three or four states would basically decide every single election. You know, New York, right. New York, California, Florida, Texas, you know, I mean, and
but the Electoral College in some sense still does that, because California has, what, 54
To a certain extent, that's true. Yeah.
That's, and New York has 27 or whatever it is. It's in that range. And Montana has three. I know.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to have to take a break right now, but I do want to continue this part of the discussion, and I have other things to say as well, believe it or not. So we'll be right back after these words. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John, and we are in the midst of a knockdown, drag-out fight. No, I'm just kidding. About the debates. Actually, what we're doing is we're sort of trying to examine from as objective a arena as possible the candidates' views on really the powers of the president, and I think we'll probably touch on the Supreme Court. And actually, I thought this last debate, at least for the first 30 minutes or so, was pretty substantive. You know, they talked about the Supreme Court and among other things. But you were commenting before about sort of the powers of the presidency and its role within the three branches and the tension there. But I think you had another point you wanted to make.
Well, yeah, and one thing that I just it continues to bother me when I watch these debates is that, you know, what it's turned into is a show, and I think both candidates are underestimating the potential sophistication of our listener public. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there that want to hear them battling each other, and they want to see how they respond to questions and see if they possess that presidential leadership and all these other things. But really, I'd really like to hear more about how a candidate really sees him or herself fitting into the way that things are run in our country. And nobody's really disagreed with the fact that we have three equal branches of government and they're supposed to be balanced. And that's why we don't have, as I said in the last segment, a one figure at the top of the heap. I mean, they don't do that in England in the parliamentary structure. Well, and by the way, their monarch is completely powerless, but it's that way by design, because we know that this is a collective experience and it's built on the fact. And I just want to say one more thing about this whole idea about not voting. If you don't vote, then you're really – I think it's irresponsible, because your opinion does matter. And if you think, no matter who you vote for or what your reasons are, the system depends upon that type of input. Now, I know we've never had mandatory voting like they do in some countries. Remember in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was.
Wouldn't it be nice to get 97% of the vote, though?
Well, right. But remember, I think there was a thing on Saturday Night Live where they said Saddam Hussein, when he was running for re-election, he got 110% of the vote.
But that is mind, really impressive. Margin. That is really impressive.
Yeah, but bear in mind, there's a 10% margin of error, so you know, a little less than that. But anyway, the idea that we have such a divided public opinion on who should be president really is a forecast for problems, again, no matter who gets elected here, because the ballots, you don't just vote for president. You go down from there. You go down the ballot and you vote for other people. And this is just the thought I had after the debate concluded earlier this week, and that is, you know, it's just interesting in retrospect. I think that potentially, and again, without taking sides here, Bernie Sanders could have launched a very effective independent campaign, but I don't think it seemed reasonable at the time that Hillary got the nomination. Likewise, I think that if the Republicans had encouraged Mr. Trump to run as an independent, there wouldn't be such a panic right now that they are feeling because of his – and both parties' potential impact on the down ticket, you know – Mm-hmm. So if somebody simply cannot vote for Hillary or cannot vote for Trump for whatever reason, that they're going to tend to vote along party lines like most people do, because it's impossible to look at your to understand and completely digest. I do the best I can, but even I don't. I spend a lot of time trying to understand who I'm voting for and why. But do you know the exact, if you vote on issues, do you know exactly how your state representative, your local assembly person, your congressman, your senator feels on every issue that is important to you? And if you really did vote along those lines, you'd scatter your votes all over the ballot, theoretically. But that's not how it works. And this is why we've really come into an era where the affiliation with one party or the other has really taken over and overshadowed, I think, accountability for people's policy statements. But I just kind of want to segue into another issue here, because we do get listener feedback. Most of it is – most of it's positive. Some of it's, you know, quite frankly, flat out negative, because for whatever reason, people seem to think I'm a – liberal. And
what
I think you are too, but
oh my god no, but that's so not true.
Actually, I just want to say something about that first, because I don't consider myself to be liberal or conservative or anything. I don't think there's any such thing as a label when you take the issue seriously. And the big thing that I would say I have in terms of my political views, I have doubt. And that's the best way I can word it. I have doubt that things will work as easily as other people say they will. And I don't care what party or what position you're talking about. I think that the world is a complicated place. And when you add lawmaking and the implementation and the execution of laws, it is such a convoluted, complicated process in how things actually end up playing out in the trenches, like you and I fight in the trenches on these things. You can see that, for example, laws never get applied the way that they were intended to. Judges never rule the way that they claim they're going to when they're running for office. And for that matter, people in the executive branch have, sometimes an inability to fulfill their own function, much less limit their own powers as they should. So, it's a big mess. And I don't, I'd like to think I'm progressive, but I think it's more optimism, I would say. So I have doubt that things work the way everybody claims they will. But at the same time, I acknowledge that if we have hope and if we have intelligence, and this is what I'm getting at, is that this particular listener was very, very kind to give feedback, and I won't name his name because I don't think he wants me to, but he was a little upset with my conclusion last week that we can't go back to the 1950s, and that if we wanted to, quote unquote, make America great again, it's not as simple as just making it Leave It to Beaver. And he had some very legitimate and correct comments, one of which is I wasn't alive in the 1950s, and that's true. I was alive in the 1960s and 70s, and that's when I grew up. But I did serve in the military throughout the 80s and 90s, and I started off as a prosecutor with my career. I don't think I've ever chosen a particular path that had anything to do with politics, but I acknowledge what this particular listener is saying, and I just want him to know that. I was going to write back to him, but I've been in trial all week. We all look back to when we were kids. I do. I don't mean we all. I just want to say a lot of us look back to when we were kids. And we think, okay, I didn't have much growing up. We somehow made ends meet. I personally was very poor growing up, but I didn't know it because it was a simpler time. I didn't want an iPhone because they didn't have them yet. My life revolved around coming in when the streetlights went on outside, and the biggest issue that ever happened that caused concern in my life was whether I scraped my knee when riding my skateboard. So I do understand the desire to clear the clutter and not have the modern world affect us as it does. And another,
well, what's
I think legitimate point.
Go ahead.
another legitimate point is that we have evolved in some ways for a variety of complicated reasons to a society that is literally inundated with some huge issues that didn't exist to the same extent in the 1950s. That being, you know, the explosion of crime and gun violence. There was gun violence back then, but not at all, of course, what we're dealing with now. And the explosion of drug abuse, particularly heroin. And yes, heroin was around back then, and there were heroin addicts, but not like we see on the scale today. But to say that we can just somehow reverse all of that sounds like something out of a movie or a fantasy novel. And we can. We can't.
Well, what's your
time. And,
yeah.
And my comment, let me just finish because we're coming up on the break here. My comment was, let's not forget some of the things that were going on back in the 1950s. That was my simple point. I didn't mean to offend anybody, but it was before tremendous advances we made in the civil rights era. We had a different view of equality when it came to women, both in the workplace as well as just in society in general. We had certainly less advanced views when it came to sexual orientation equality. You know, there are a lot of things that we all must agree we cannot and should not reverse. That would be there's no way to do it. And secondly, there is just it's wrong to say let's go back and get rid of civil rights. Let's go back and get rid of equality and all the things that we've done. The progress that we've made along those lines. Now, is the world more complicated and a more difficult place? Do we have the terrorist issues? Now, of course we do. And those are all things we wish we didn't have. But I don't think any president, certainly not either one of these two, has a way of taking us back to when things were, you know, less complicated.
Well, what you're talking about here are people's paradigm perceptions that have built up over the series of decades.
Personal perceptions.
Well, let's after the break. And after the break, let's pick this up and we'll kind of apply it to the current election.
All right, we'll be right back after these words. Now here comes the musical sound that really leaves the town. So the black
white pink are coming down the line of clowns. Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
And we're back with more Legal Defense. Right before the break, we were talking about, again, the role of the chief executive. But I want to segue into another topic that, of course, came up during the presidential debates that we just saw, and that is the Supreme Court. And it is true that the president is responsible for nominating potential candidates for the Supreme Court. Of course, it then goes to the Senate, who conducts more or less an investigation and approves potentially the nomination. And if it doesn't work out, there's got to be another nomination. So we've seen that happen
many times,
many times. But the thing is, and this is something that didn't used to happen until I would say well into the 1960s, 1970s, when, you know, partisan considerations were so much more considered in terms of that nomination process. And now we've come into an era where, and I just want to, this is a little side note here, but has it ever occurred to you that when a Supreme Court justice, a sitting Supreme Court justice, and this also applies to our state Supreme Courts and even our circuit courts and courts of appeals in the state, that a sitting justice, himself or herself, has the potential ability to affect the politics of the judge who will replace that person? You know how? By the timing of the announcement of that person's retirement. I'm sure that's occurred to you.
Of course.
Depending on who is president now or who is governor now, and knowing that and in reality, it's a sad statement on the fact that it's well known and acknowledged that our executive, whoever that may be, whether it's the governor or the president, is going to exercise partisan politics in the process of naming that nominee. So, say, for example,
well,
a sitting
look,
Supreme Court Justice
Warren,
knows
Warren,
that—
Warren Burger, former Chief Justice, Earl Warren, rather. He was governor of California. He was never even a judge before he became Chief Justice. You know?
Right.
I mean—
It's been a long time. Well, I think Warren's the last example, right, of somebody that walked right in without any actual court experience. But
I think the more important question here is what do these two candidates? I mean, if we watch the debate, what are they really offering us in terms of what they would propose for a Supreme Court justice? Well, you know what? Donald Trump clearly doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to how the court works or how decisions are made or anything like that. It's just like he just knows what he likes and what he doesn't like and, it has nothing to do with legal reasoning or anything like that. And Hillary kind of just as bad in a sense that she's just going to, going to uphold Roe v. Wade, et cetera. And this is we're going to strike down Heller and I get that. That's sort of the same basket for both of them, I think. And I think the bigger question is really what about the court as an institution and how should it be structured? Because right now they're limping along with eight justices, but there's a growing body of commentators that are talking about maybe that's not such a bad thing and maybe we ought to consider restructuring the court. If you remember, the number nine was just arrived at in 1869. And if you remember the court packing issue in the 30s, where Roosevelt kept getting his stuff knocked down and he was going to expand it to 16 members because he wanted to be able to pack the court. And one of the justices switched, and it was called the switch in time that saved nine. And so now maybe this is a historic milestone where we need to consider not only restructuring the number, but maybe restructuring the role of each of those justices, because this is just food for thought here. And I don't know, I haven't thought about it enough to really have a strong opinion on it one way or another. But this was a proposal by Eric Siegel, who's a law professor in at George Washington Law. He says that, well, you know what? Why don't we have four members of the court, Republican, four members Democrat, and it allow them sort of the flexibility to fight over whether it should be 6-2 or 7-1 or whatever, as opposed to our current thing where we end up with a bunch of 5-4 decisions. And the president, whoever the sitting president is, if one of the members of the court from an opposite party retires or dies, they have to appoint somebody from that party. There's nothing in the Constitution that says you can't do this. Now, the question will become, is that a good idea? And I think the fundamental issue is, do we want this body to be so influential over policy in America? Or do we want the legislative bodies to be doing the bulk of that? For example, gay marriage, abortion, things like civil rights. I mean, shouldn't these be questions addressed by our elected officials as opposed to this very tiny yet all too powerful body that seems to be able to really shape the national agenda at this point, right? I mean,
exactly.
And I have mixed feelings about it. I don't know how you feel about it. I have mixed feelings about it because...
Well, yeah, I've always assumed, and maybe I'm wrong, I've always assumed that the number nine is one that works because it's an odd number. I mean, that seems, logical, but based on what Professor Siegel is saying, maybe that's not the all-important thing. But, that's a really, really interesting...
Well, listen to this. In terms of... This is Kennedy... Justice Kennedy, he was the deciding vote in 85% of the 167 decisions that were 5-4 under John Roberts. So think about that. 85% of the time, Justice Kennedy, and 95% in important constitutional questions, was the deciding vote. So for the last 10 years, we've basically been living in Justice Kennedy's world. Now,
yeah,
I don't mind Justice Kennedy particularly, but do we want that structure? And even though it's true that we had all those 5-4 splits, really the vast majority of Supreme Court cases are by a wide majority or unanimous.
Yeah, and I guess I do see some of the wisdom with that proposal in the sense that put it on the Supreme Court to make sure that they are effective. Because if they consistently have 4-4 votes on everything, they'll become irrelevant. So it's their responsibility to come to – I mean, it kind of forces the debate rather than just having everybody fall along their normal lines.
Doesn't it force the political branches to actually forge some compromise?
Right, and I wish there was a way, but I do like that as a potential solution to take to the maximum extent possible. You know, you can't take politics out of the Supreme Court, but you can make it so with mechanisms such as that, so that it's not based purely on politics. So, which is why I was disappointed with both answers at the debate. Mr. Trump says, "I want someone who's going to enforce the Second Amendment." Hillary says, "I want someone who's going to support Roe v. Wade." Okay, well, you know, I can't imagine.
It's such a myopic view of the law.
I can't imagine
court.
Going through an entire career of studying the law for 30, 40 or more years, and all the complexities that are involved with constitutional law and the balancing of rights and a real clear, to the extent that that's possible, understanding of the nuances of not only what the Constitution says, but the history of its interpretation in so many different ways. And then to have it boiled down to, hey, Mr. or Mrs. Supreme Court Justice nominee, well, how do you feel about Roe v. Wade? I mean, that's dumb.
I know. I have mixed feelings because some of those 5-4 splits are really fundamental rights. And it's kind of like sometimes we just need somebody to give us an answer. And sometimes we don't like the answer.
Hey, we got to take a break.
Yeah, we have to take a break. So let's pick this up.
Time for a little break here. So we'll be right back after you hear from our sponsors. Stay tuned.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. It is a glorious, amazing fall day here in Wisconsin. And we're having a blast talking about these two candidates, I use that air quotes, their positions on various subjects. And right now, it's one of our favorite subjects, SCOTUS, or is it SCOTUS? We couldn't decide that last week. We're going to need an intervention from an English major. Maybe an English teacher out there somewhere can give us a pronunciation.
Or the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language might have a pronunciation.
I'm not sure they're going to have one on an abbreviation like that, but
they might. I think they do. They have acronyms and things like that.
See, you are so intellectual. See, I wouldn't even thought of that. I'm I'm way too pedestrian to think about lofty things like dictionaries. And, you know, maybe it's a Sheboygan thing that you guys are that, you know, highbrow. But I don't know.
Could be. Yeah, we're highfalutin up here. But
so
if God forbid I was ever a candidate for president, which I never intend to be. But if that were to happen and it were my misfortune, I think that my criteria for who would be an ideal Supreme Court justice would be one that does not have political party leanings and is educated, scholarly, intelligent, and careful because care is the most important aspect of any interpretation of the law, and I would
interject here, and I would say, caring is more important as opposed to caring about people.
But one of the questions that was asked but not answered by either candidate, I will point out, because I was very pleased with Chris Wallace's
he was excellent. He was really did a well
trying to get the candidates to talk about the issue. But when he brought up the issue of the Supreme Court, he asked the question that I'm most interested in, and that is you know, you two candidates, do you believe that the Constitution says what it says and there's no more interpretation required, or you believe it's a living, breathing document? And of course, that's the dividing line.
Isn't it, though?
Amongst many, many, many justices and judges in even in this on the state level, as to whether or not a strict interpretation of words mean what they say versus can you apply it in terms of context? Can you is it designed to be something that is viewed in a modern light, so to speak? Now, it's actually a very complicated subject because
it's a really, thorny.
Right. Because the idea that words say what they say is has a natural appeal to it.
Yeah. But
because then it's simple. And we would love to have black and white tests, bright line rules. Those are so easy to us that deal with the law, because then you know what the right answer is. You know, you look at where that comma is in the sentence. You look at whether they used a semicolon or a capital letter in how they drafted the law, and you impart almost, you know, heavenly clairvoyance into the thought process that produced these laws. But as Teddy Roosevelt once said, if you could see how laws are made and you could see how sausage is made in the sausage factory, they would both make you sick.
Well, here's the thing. That's funny. Here's the thing, though. The people see what they want to see. So you could look at the same exact text and be a textualist like a Scalia or a Thomas, which I don't necessarily disagree with because there's some validity to it.
Well, it makes sense.
But you know, but people look at the same words and they interpret those words differently because they have a different worldview. They have a different paradigm through which they view the world and indeed the law. So if you look at the Fourth Amendment, it says, you know, you have to have a warrant if you want to search somebody's house. Well, you know, some people look at it.
Seems pretty simple, right?
Seems pretty simple, but then some people will say, "Well, no. It's reasonableness. You can't do unreasonable searches. Those are the ones you need warrants for. Reasonable searches,
and you can't have
you can do anything
you
want.
You can't have bright line rules when it comes to the real world, well, right? That's where this exigent circumstance.
Well,
the whole living
Constitution thing is a legitimate debate because. I don't know how textualists and originalists can say with a straight face that we can look at this document and know what the founders thought about email searches or about phone right. searches or about right. The rights of black people to have fundamental rights in this country when at the founding they didn't. They were 3/5 of a person, right. if you remember. So
yeah, that's a good point, because if we followed that rule, we wouldn't have, you know, we would not be respecting the rights of black citizens.
So there's
the Constitution.
Right. So there's growth over time. I mean, you know, the whole idea that the progress. Is not to be taken into account. I mean, technological process, humanity progress, such as abolishing slavery, etc. To say that those aren't to be taken into account is really living with blinders. And I think the strong and the powerful, the rich and the powerful, they want the status quo all the time. And that's really what's bolstering up, I think, Trump's campaign, is because they truly want to return to pre-Obama era, because they can't stand the thought of having, you know, their power structures dismantled rather. And you know, I mean, if you look at the Koch brothers and the Sheldon Adelson, those types of rich, powerful donors who are even in Milwaukee in Wisconsin, the Bradley Foundation, you know, these huge powerful forces that influence legislation from the ground up, not just Congress, but every state legislature. I mean, ALEC is captured by these corporate interests and basically write the laws. And so, you know, to say that we want to keep things intact as is all the time, I mean, that's sort of the same philosophy all the way around. It's got a certain appeal to it.
Well, it's ironic.
It. It's got a certain appeal to
it. It's ironic that the advent of, and this is how my constitutional law professor worded it, a squishy interpretation of the Constitution, really where it started taking off was expanding a view of the Commerce Clause.
Commerce Clause, yes, absolutely.
Ironically, we have so much government involvement in our lives right now because of interpretations of the Commerce Clause that go back more than 100 years. And ironically—
Including the federal criminal laws.
Yes, that's why we have federal gun laws. That's why we have federal drug laws. That's why we have, you know, immigration laws and all these things that typically are seen as, you know, well, it's been called overreaching by some. But it's interesting because all of that emanated from the idea that the Supreme Court could somehow involve itself in things that had to do with people wanting to get rich. I mean, that's really what it came down to with a lot of these cases that went up to the Supreme Court, and people were urging the Supreme Court to weigh in on a matter that they felt the Supreme Court would have that ability based upon the fact that the Commerce Clause should be read broadly and loosely and based upon the current status of the country. And, you know, it's just kind of ironic when people point that out. But, you know, you raise a very good point, and particularly about the Fourth Amendment, because it's one of the amendments that has the fewest words but the most case law.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
You know, because when we have a rule, a very, very simple rule, you know, you got to have a warrant, and if there shall be no search without a warrant except upon probable cause. Well, those are very nice words, but they have rung hollow in our efforts to define what they mean over the years. And there has been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples where, yeah, that's what it says, but we got to consider the reality of the situation. And I mentioned before the exigent circumstances exception, nowhere to be found in the Constitution, but wholly judicially created by the courts, which means, oh yeah, I know it says no warrant, but you know, you got to think about the fact that in the reality of the situation, when the cop is chasing the bad guy, when he's going after, you know, the hombre and is trying to catch him, he doesn't have time to get a warrant. Well, you know, maybe our founding fathers just didn't want that to happen, but instead we infer.
So, and, you know, so isn't that the original language there, for God's sake?
Scalia was awfully good at inferring things, even though he was a textualist. You know, it's not necessarily what were you saying?
I was going to say, isn't that what it says? But I mean, so, you know, after the break, I'm going to bring up a really pointed question on this very point.
All right. Well, there is no other break because this is our last segment.
Oh. All right. That's too bad. But then we'll have to bring it up next week.
We'll have to bring it up next week. So thanks so much for tuning in to Legal Offense with Kirk and John. Have a great weekend, and tune in next week, as you can every week, right here on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL. Sayonara.